Hello, pals o' mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. I live within a short drive of several wineries, and it's so relaxing to drive through acres of flat and rolling hills of grapevines, stop periodically to taste new wines and old favorites, and of course, bring home a tasty bounty to enjoy later. A favorite spot of locals is the Charles Mitchell Vineyards. It has over 50 lovely products to choose from, and Friday pizza night, which includes Maine lobster and a bocce ball court for impromptu games. But the piece de resistance is Charles Mitchell himself. He's an adventurer, a pilot, a storyteller, and a champion for France.
So you recently took a trip to Sicily?
Well, I was heading there, that's correct. When you're on an airplane and you go like this.
You stretch your legs
and
out.
And you lay back, and they serve you filet mignon. Where are you in the airplane?
Not in coach.
No. So you're in the front. And you have a bed, by the way. So that part was good. Okay. So, So I met my girlfriend. You really want to hear this whole story?
I wouldn't have asked. I
met my girlfriend at JFK in the Admiral's Club. So then we proceeded to Roma. Okay. And because we're non-revving, we don't make advance reservations, because we don't know if we're going to have a seat, right? So we went to get reservations in Sicily, and she said, well, you know what? It's from Roma, it's a long way. So you can take a ferry boat. They weren't running. It was in summertime. You can go to Naples in a bus or a train, and you can take a train. They take a train on the ferry boat. Can you believe that one? So it's only 4 kilometers. So it wasn't working. It would have taken 12 hours or so.
A train on a ferry boat?
Yep.
So the tracks lead right up literally to the edge?
I never got that far, but,
oh, okay.
But I read that was happening, yeah. So so we decided, where are we going to go? So we decided to go to Santa Margherita. Well, we were supposed to also go to the island of Malta, which didn't work either. So we went to Santa Margherita, a charming coastal city in the Italian Riviera, where it has a fleet of small boats in a harbor, fishing boats, a fishmonger place down by the water. It's very nice. It has restaurants and more restaurants and hotels and piazza and old buildings and so on. That's where we spent our time. And we went to Portofino, which is only 10 kilometers away. The old world is always charming, and the old world is an inspiration. It should be anyway. And the old world is always, I always learn, always.
It's nice. It's like the continental divide. You have 1 foot in the present and 1 foot in the past.
Well, I was happening to be at my birthday, so my girlfriend bought me this absolutely lovely dinner. It wasn't Italian. It was seafood. It had abalone. It had pages and pages of seafood, whelks, and plus foie gras, if you can believe that one. So that was a charming time. I will have to wear a hat because my skin is so bad. I have Irish skin, so I looked in my closet. No, not that hat, not that hat, not that. What? Ah! Ducati hat with the Italian flag on the back of it, right? So I wore the Ducati hat. You know how many people pulled me over on the street to talk about Ducatis? So plus it led to being more of a local, where I got to have conversations with locals that spoke English. Santa Margherita, nice dinner, lots of wine, beautiful hotel, ferry boat rides, that kind of stuff. Sitting in the piazza, having a beer. It was very nice. And then first class going home. So
delays happen a lot. Presidents get their haircuts and delay air flights. But you had the Pope.
Oh, well, it was, the Pope was in New York right then. And that affected air traffic control. It affected customs and immigration because there were long lines. I don't know why it did, but it did. And so my friend that I was with is a flight attendant. So she's a crew. She has the documents. So she can go around all that stuff, and which she did. So we had 5 bottles of wine, 3 limoncellos, which from Naples, and then aboard the plane, they knew it was my birthday, so she got them to give me a bottle of champagne.
Nice.
And a bottle of red wine, and it was from Champagne. So
actual champagne.
Real champagne. So she goes through with her 3 bottles of limoncello. I said, Stacy, don't desert me. I said, I got liquids, you know. So I'm putting them onto the conveyor belt, and I'm going to just surrender them. And she goes like this, and she comes back in somehow, which you can't do. And she goes like this,
just grabs them all.
All of a sudden, I get through security, after they pat me down, they like to smile when they pat you down. And there she was with three bottles of limoncello, champagne, and red wine.
You've had a lot of troubles.
Well, I have a passion for things.
Yeah.
I have a passion for wine. What I believe is that you learn there's other cultures. There's other ways to live. And by opening our eyes up, we live better. If we're willing to open our eyes up. Some people aren't. So I always learn. For example, I used to have a girlfriend in St. Petersburg. I used to smuggle icons, and among other things. So so that was an adventure and a learning experience. The Russian people don't live like we do. Did they live worse? No. Did they live better? No. They live different.
What stood out for you during those trips?
I lived in Ecuador for a short time, in Quito. So that was an experience.
But for example, in other words, what resonated with you? What made an impact on you?
Well, I would say going to the Russian sauna with Natasha, darling, you know. So that made an impact. Drinking wine all around the world.
You know. Presentation and the different terrain. And
just different people's point of view. For example, I happen to like South America. So we have Uruguay, we have Argentina, Mendoza, we have Chile, we have some pretty big producers of wine down there, but they have a different point of view than California.
For example?
Okay, the tasting protocol. Okay, for example, let's take Mendoza. Mendoza has a charming old world center to it, with a park, of course, and a cathedral, and a Hyatt, so and a lot of restaurants, okay? But, and that's what the tourist sees. Then you go half mile out into the city, now it's dirt roads, and hovels, what we would call hovels. And so that I haven't seen in the United States or California. So, and then you come to various tasting situations. It's not like here where you go to the Sierra Foothills or Napa Valley or the coastal areas or wherever. It's not the same. It isn't the same experience. It's not done like California. So there's not a row of places with smiling people. Then there's the high-end thing.
During the interview, an employee called asking for him to sign her paycheck. These are his comments after ending the call.
That was about paychecks. I have this philosophy about paychecks. I think that every once in a while, maybe once a year, people shouldn't get paid at all. I mean, they ought to just say, oh, okay, Mr. Mitchell, you're so lovely. Just, I don't want my paycheck this pay period. So, and, but it hasn't happened yet, you know. So.
Really?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm waiting. I even suggest it.
It's always good to have a goal, a dream.
Yeah.
Joking aside, he later told me that he has taken his staff on European trips for the last 3 years. So they tolerate his sometimes curmudgeon moods. Back to the interview.
Their wine tasting is different than California.
Yes.
Do they just have like a farmer's market stand up by the roadside?
No. No, they don't. And now remember, they're the new world, so they have no more history in wine than we do in California. So they somehow got on this Malbec thing, which of course is from Bordeaux. And their big thing is Malbec. Of course it's not. There's no wines that are indigenous. There's no Vitis vinifera indigenous to the Western Hemisphere. There are none. From Antarctica to the Arctic, there are none. So they're all from the old world. So we all borrow ideas, concepts, passion from the old world. They as well as us. But it's developed differently. For example, this, I don't know his name, I have Lace Potato Chip, has this palatial wine tasting facility. And these three tourney ladies were taking a cooking class there and laughing from New York. And palatial, I'm talking. Wines are $80 a bottle, and they have plenty of customers. It's 2 hours driving time from Mendoza. And it's, actually the name of that one is Alta Andy, something like that. And so there's the Andes. White as hell, right there, right?
Nice.
Spack, right in the middle of your face. Now remember, those are 26,000 feet, and so we're up high.
Altitudes.
Yeah, so it's a different growing situation. Just like various California valleys have valleys. Someone said, well, how long have you lived in the valley? Well, I don't live in a valley. I live in a cote, like the Côte d'Or, or other cotes from France, of course. Côte rôti is what we're like. What's a cote? Side of a hill, okay? Just like in France. Top of the hill was eroded away. It's not fertile. It's not good for grape growing. They wouldn't allow it in France. So you come down a little bit, and now you've got a mix of pretty good soil. So now you're in Premier Cru, Okay. And then you're going a little bit further. Now you're in the heart of the Côte, Grand Cru. Okay. Guess where your feet are right now? The heart of the Côte. So the potential here is Grand Cru. And so then we go down the slope a little further. What do we have there? Premier Cru. Then we go to the bottom of the slope. What do we have there? Fertile soil, a river bottom, okay? Sort of like Lodi. And they would not allow you to grow grapes there. It's suitable for tomatoes, okay? Not Vitis vinifera. I'll say that about Lodi. Lodi is suitable for tomatoes. And there's a few too many tomato farmers down there growing grapes.
It was kind of surprising when Lodi suddenly, like a jack-in-the-box, popped up as a go-to.
Unbelievable. When I started here, when I was in a midlife crisis, there was 3 tasting rooms in Lodi. Now there's 103. And there's ag money down there, a lot of money. They have some very, very nice facilities. Nevertheless, it's the bottom of the Côte, okay?
Now, speaking of old worlds,
yeah.
Where did you grow up? What part of the country?
Wisconsin.
Ah.
I was born in Port Washington, Wisconsin.
What did your parents do?
My father was a teacher, a school teacher. He had a lot of degrees. So he was a smart guy. Let's put it this way. One of his master's degrees hangs on my wall in my office.
Oh, nice.
My daughter's had several degrees from Paris. Those hang on my wall. My son has a degree from San Francisco State. That hangs on my wall. And then beneath that is a high school diploma.
Well, there has to be a foundation of some sort. Now, having a father as a teacher, do you think that promoted your inherent curiosity?
No, he was more structured. See, winemaking...
Traditional.
There's 3 parts to winemaking. One is artistic, ideas. 2 is technical, okay, a chemist, okay? 3 is magic. And although I have processed wine here myself, I've been the winemaker, I am the winemaker, my contribution to that mix is the artistic side. For example, I'm in Italy, they're pressing, there's a wagon load full of skins, and I say, where's it going? The distillery, where do you think it's going? As soon as I came home, I call Hork at St. George, who's not there anymore, but anyway, he used to own it, and get it, Hork, George. So I said, Hork, Charles here, please make me some grappa. He says, I don't have time. I said, make me some grappa. He goes, all right, I'll make you some grappa. So it's made from my grapes, okay? It's called a pumice it's made from. So that was an inspiration from Tuscany, okay? I was in Neuilly-Saint-Georges in Burgundy, beautiful storybook town, and I was buying these, it's all grapes. So the business is geared to grapes, right? So I was buying these little things like this, little candle things, and you move them like that, you know, old-fashioned looking. So my daughter said, well, we have an appointment with John Charles Boisse. I said, well, we're going to buy the candles. He said, you're going to buy candle holders? And you have an appointment with John Charles Boisse? I said, yes. So Mr. Boisse, he's the rock star of the world of wine today. So I'm lucky enough to be a friend of his and import his wine. Just got some in last week. I got about 600 cases of Sparkler. So it was after hours. He now lives in California, but he's a Burgundian. So he owns lots of wineries, and they're very, very nice. Well, Raymond on Highway 29, for example, who has 7 tasting rooms. One of them is for dogs. Okay. So one time we went out to dinner and lunch, and he said, would you like a red or a white? And what would you have said?
Red.
No, I said yes.
If it was one of those days, I would probably have responded similarly.
So... okay, so that's an inspiration. Why is it? Well, I told you, I just got a carload of his wine in just this week, this week. So wherever I go, I'm inspired by people.
What's some of the oldest winemaking places that you've been to? Not necessarily vineyards, but especially in Italy where they make their own families.
I host wine trips to customers. We have small groups of around 12 approximately. We were in Chateauneuf-du-Pape a year ago. So my daughter sets these up. She's a Francophile. She's spent most of her adult life in France. So she said, let's go to this cave. It was 13th century in Chateauneuf-du-Pape. It was very, very touristy if you haven't been there. And they're famous. They claim that the first appellation ever. And in 1929, Bandol claims they are. Who is, I don't know. But we all copy that concept. Who's we? Well, Californians. Americans, AVA, American Viticultural Area. Italians, DOC. Well, Spanish. Everyone copies Chile, Argentina. Every wine growing area copies the French. Okay, they've been there a little longer. They know a little more than we do. Did you know that? They're more fashionable than we are.
Let's just say that they think they are.
They are. One time I had a gal, several of these young gals came to be an intern here to learn how to make wine. When they get off of the airplane, you don't say, "Why are you wearing purple socks?" You know she's French. Period. She doesn't look anything like anyone else. She walks differently. The French are fashionable. The French know more about wine than we do. The French are cool. Period.
I can't tell you when it was because I don't remember dates. But there was a year when they lost a lot of crops. And they actually used a California grape that they grafted.
Where did you read that?
To save.
Well, that's
I read it in a couple different places.
That's the phylloxera thing. Why did they use California grape?
Because it was a particular strain that was immune to that particular disease.
I'll tell you why. I'll tell you the real reason why.
Okay.
How did they get phylloxera? They got phylloxera from California. Where the hell do you think they got it? We infected all of France. Oh, and Spain. Oh, and Italy. We ruined the wine business in those countries. So how did they figure out what they can do about it? You can't get rid of it. So they graft to Vitis riparia, or a rootstock that's from America that you can't make wine from.
So how did they get it to begin with?
Somebody in the 1870s decided that let's take over some American Concord grapes. That's how they got it. And then UC Davis, in his brilliance, decided AXR1, we should plant on that. Its parentage is Vitis vinifera. This was in the 70s and 80s. Guess what? All of Napa Valley, all of it, because it's contiguous, it just spreads, was replanted. All of it was replanted. Not for millions, for billions, because we were told to use AXR1. So I used to go to seminars. This was in the 90s when we did this. Most all grapes are on resistant rootstock. So other things, there are nematodes, there's black measles, there's all kinds of Pierce's disease. There's a disease of the year for grapes, okay? Anyway, I used to go to these seminars, a lot of UC Davis things, like a weekend seminar, about how we're going to replant. Well, let me learn. I want to learn a little bit about how these brilliant people in California are going to replant. Well, one guy stood up. He said, "Well, I'm doing 11 feet rows." Well, if you're in France, it's meter by meter. So I won't bother explaining, but that's the way it is. He said, "I'm doing 11 feet." I said, "Well, why is that?" "Oh, because I got big tractors." Does that make any sense?
Wasn't that how the roads were built in Rome? That was the width of the...
Well, that was just there. Okay, so in France, they have too many ruins in Rome. Not my kind of place.
You can't get good help these days.
So here, I'll give you... Here's the tractors we use in the U.S. Like I just said, 11-foot rows. Okay, we use the same tractor, the same John Deere, that's used to plant corn. Same thing. We don't have a grape tractor. Lord forbid, why would we do that? You go to France, guess what they have? We spray one row at a time, pulling a big tank. So when you get to the end of the row, we need to sacrifice that very, very valuable real property to turn the tank around. They don't. They have a straddle system. By the way, the cabin's air-conditioned. It's all built in. They spray, these arms come down like this. They spray seven rows at a time. We spray one. Now, because of the laws and inheritance laws and so on, in Burgundy especially, this one grower may own 2-3 rows of vines, and he has to go 5 kilometers and owns another 10 rows there. That's just the way it is. He gets in his tractor, just looks like that, and gets it on the highway, and he scoots along at 40, 50 miles an hour. If we were to move our tanks and tractors, remember, they're made for corn, not for grapes. How fast do they go? You know, 12 miles an hour, 15 miles an hour? 20 maybe? Okay. So the difference between France wine grape growing and ours is enormous. It's huge.
So what was your epiphany, your moment of clarity when you knew that you had to have your own vineyard? From learning, attending these workshops, all these trips,
yeah,
and
well,
tastings
I,
that you had, that you just had this intuition that I have to do this.
I had this mission in the early 90s, and it was to go to every winery in California. Now, in those days, there was only 800 bonded wineries compared to today, 3,600. So it wasn't such a big job. So I went to every wine region in California, pretty much every winery, and just to see what's happening. And then I had other reasons to go, and I won't bore you with those. So, you know, I'd never been to the Sierra Foothills. I was living in Mammoth Lakes, the ski area at the time. I lived there for 10 season passes. And in the biggest house in town, just to set the stage. I thought, you know, I've never been over the hill other than to get an instrument rating in Fresno, which is another story. I was with a Swedish guy, the instructor. I said, this is really boring flying to Fresno every day. I said, what if we flew to the Bahamas? Would I be instrument rated? He says, yes. I said, pack your bag. We're leaving in the morning. So I thought, I'll go to the Cerro. So I went. It actually took 2 weekends. So I went for 4 days. Met Dick Bush, met everyone, actually. And said to Dick Bush, Madronia, that's Madronia Winery. And I said, is there any wineries for sale? He said, yeah. I said, Vernon Gerwer places for sale. I said, okay. So I went down and bought it. Now, when I bought it, the road was slow because there were potholes in the road, typical of this area. And however, I decided to put speed bumps. So we traded in the potholes for speed bumps. And it was a midlife crisis.
So the wheels would go up instead of down.
Huh?
The wheels would go up instead of... You're so contrary.
Thank you.
Now, how many acres did you finally settle on? Did you have initially, or did you expand? You know, how is the...
This particular parcel here is a 40-acre parcel. But I then decided to buy and sell wineries. And so I bought next door, you look way up on that hill. I bought that 67 acres over there and created a bed and breakfast. And then I bought a winery in Amador County. And then I bought another winery in Amador County. So I've had very... And then I sold some of them. So now I only have two. That's the story. So various. Right now, on this parcel, I grow 15 acres of Vitis vinifera. And then I purchase grapes from mostly Fairplay Appellation. But there's some... there's a little bit of Amador here and there. And I don't just buy grapes. We check the vineyard, we reject the vineyard. I don't like the way they prune. I don't want their fruit. Then we'll see how it's growing. Not once, but all during the growing season. You know, we don't like the way you're growing the grapes. So I don't want them. So we're serious operators. And so the products are good.
Very selective.
Yeah. We're pretty much today things are into vineyard designation. The French have appellation systems. And so their theory, the smaller the guarantee of origin, the terroir, then that the greater the potential quality, because it's not, for example, if you bought a $2 bottle of wine, it would be made from Thompson seedless grapes in the valley where they get 20 tons per acre. The French think that yields are everything. So they don't use acres, they have hectares, so they have hectoliters per hectare. Like here, for example, in my potentially Grand Cru here, right here, we get 2 tons per acre. Lodi gets 8 tons per acre, 10 maybe. Fresno gets maybe 20. So the French think that yields, in fact, they control it. If you're in a Grand Cru, you can only get, depending on the appellation, you can only get, say, 35 hectoliters per hectare. It's not allowed to grow more. They're regulated.
Now you mentioned one, but what type of wines do you like to offer? What are your favorites?
That's close to my heart. I'm a Bordeaux man. Because if you get a famous wine that's ageable, like Chateau Lafite, a first growth, Chateau Latour, Chateau Margaux, those are all Cabernet Sauvignon. So I was hosting a trip to Italy, the south of France, in Provence, last year, and we went to this over-the-top winery. It was like over-the-top. So in every respect, architecture, art, lunch there, and so on. And I thought, I'm not going to be a Mr. Know-it-all, because I'm the host. My daughter sets everything up because she's a Francophile, and I'm the color man. So I've stepped to the back of the line. Zip. So then this guy comes up, our host, and he says, welcome. Michel, your group. And he says, I'm a Burgundian. Now I step to the front of the line. And I said, well, I'm from Bordeaux. And he says, well, Bordeaux wines taste like pine needles when they're not ripe. I said, well, Burgundy wines taste like dishwater when they're not ripe. And he goes, well, so I said, here, rather than get into technical discussion, why don't we arm wrestle? So he said, okay. So he let me win. That was the end of our discussion.
Very diplomatic.
But I'm a Bordeaux man. That's my deal. So I offer 50 products or so, but I also have various... When I told you, I'm inspired by where I go. So then I want to do what they're doing. I have for example, I have a Super Tuscan made with Sangiovese. Why do I have a Super Tuscan? Because we were had a private tasting with this guy, and I forgot his name, Francois, I think his name. So he was actually French, but he owned a winery there, and a little winery. like mine. He's chopping the cheese. We're in this little shed thing, and I'm a lean-to, and he had cheese, some sausage, and then we had lots of Chiantis. So I said, why don't you open that one? And he said, oh, he said, this is bringing 85 euros in the village. And so I went like this. Went into my pocket, and I went like this.
Pulled out the bills.
And he said, what's that? And I said, 85 euros. So we drank it. So all this is an inspiration, right? It has to be, doesn't it?
Of course.
All right.
That's part of the magic, right?
Absolutely. So that's why I have a Super Tuscan. So no matter where I go, I learn.
Now, you mentioned cheese earlier. You have pizza night here on Friday.
Yes, I do.
So tell me, what wines are paired with your pizzas?
Oh, boy, which wines aren't? I mean, well, I've been making, I'm 74 years old. And I've been making, I started my first pizza probably when I was in my mid-20s. And so I've been making pizza for 50 years. But you had a specific question. Well, I'm going to go further. And then I have pizza and lobster every Friday night. Why do I have pizza and lobster? Because I like pizza and I like lobster.
Simple enough.
And I used to have a little dive boat and fish for lobster. Not real cold water lobsters, but California spiny lobsters. A little different thing, but nevertheless, similar.
Fresh catch.
Yes. I used to live in L.A., so I used to go over to Catalina and back and forth. And a little Boston Whaler. And if I missed the island because it was fog, then where do you end up?
I've never missed the island.
Japan.
That's a 3-hour tour. A lot of reruns. So
I do pizza and lobster. Now, pizza, I will grant you, has carbohydrates. Now, remember, I was in Italy just 3 weeks ago, and gluten. So my understanding, that stuff's hard to digest. So we do a 7-ounce dough that's 14 inches. So it's like a cracker.
Yeah, I love those.
And I was in San Francisco last week eating at one of the 100 best restaurants in town, according to the Chronicle. Cracker thin pizza. So we have a wood-burning pizza oven, and ours are 7-ounce plus the crust. So let's say you don't eat the crust. Well, you got to have some carbohydrates. You need to have wine, right? So you don't have to overdo it by having one of the Mitchell pizzas. And then if you want some protein, go for the lobster. And fat. Fat is, the cheese is really good for you. Where's pizza from? From Naples. Well, I would think you'd have a Chianti or a Sangiovese. Wouldn't that make sense? Saying that, Sangiovese is a light-colored wine. What's a Super Tuscan? We just put some Bordeaux in there and pick up the pace. That's what it is. So you could have, I have Sangiovese as a varietal. I also have, I already told you, I have my Bella Rosa Super Tuscan. There's two. Zinfandel. Zinfandel, great. It's a very large berry with a thin skin. It doesn't extract much phenolics or color. And people say, well, I've had a big Zin. Well, that's because it's been blended to probably Petite Syrah. It's very common in California. I grow Petite here, and it's not Petite at all. And I had it for sale at bulk wine. So who called me but Domaine Canaros, the Tattinger people who I befriended. And now when I go to Rance with a group, I go to Tattinger, and they treat me like I'm special. So this French lady came out. Remember, I told you earlier, you can tell a French lady by the way they walk. She came out and climbed up tank, ladder in the tank, an oenologist, no less, without a lab coat, with a fancy dress on. And I said, well, why do you want my petite? I said, you don't have a petite program. She said, to pick up the pace on her famous gate, Pinot Noir from Canaros. So their $80 Pinot Noir that year was blended to my Charles B. Mitchell Petite Syrah, which we're allowed to do up to 25%. I have no idea what they used, probably 2%, 5%, I don't know. But that's what they did to pick up the pace. Get it? Okay. Now, let's get back to Zinfandel. We got to pick up the pace. It's a little wishy-washy sometimes. Okay, what do we do? Petite Syrah. It's done everywhere in California, almost exclusively. Almost everyone does it, okay? Do I make a light Zin? I make 12 Zins. Do I make a light Zin? Sure. Some people want a light Zin. Do I make a high alcohol? Yeah. Do I make a low? Yeah. Do I make a pink one? Yes. All right. Primitivo. It sounds Italian to me.
Got an O at the end. It must be.
Must be. And then Primitivo, yeah. No, that's Norway. So, let's see. Well, Barbera, not my favorite pizza wine, but it's Italian. Then Nebbiolo, a little too refined. It's sort of like, if you don't know what it is, it's sort of like an Italian Pinot Noir, which could be a pizza wine. If you want to, you say, well, there's cheese, lots of cheese, and maybe sausage, and maybe pepperoni. If you want to, you could, Lord forbid, use a cab. I hope I don't get struck down by higher power. But
make sure I've left the building first, okay? That would be grand.
Yeah. Use your imagination, okay? How about a sparkling wine? A method traditional, like I import from France. How about one of those? Sure. Why not? All right. Use your imagination, all right?
But you also have some interesting old pieces around here, like airplane propellers. What's the story there?
Well, I fly to work. Doesn't everybody?
Well, apparently you didn't make it to work one day because they're separate. They're sitting on the porch.
Well, I flew to work today.
Okay. When do you fly?
I fly from my house. I live on the water, so I have boats and such, paddle boards and so on. And I have an airplane, a seaplane at my dock. So I just walked down my dock, cast off. This morning, for example, I didn't like the current. We have tide where I live. It was drifting me into a piling, the wing of the aircraft, which, no. So I took out a docking pole, you go, and then it's real long, and I had to fend it off. Now I had to go through past a seawall with a small opening. My wings are, I think they're around 38 feet, and this opening is around 40-something. And so,
tight.
So at high tide, no problem. My wings go over the top. Low tide, we got an issue. Well, I thought, you know what? It was calm winds. All I had was the current working. It was a flood current, by the way. I thought, all right, let's go for it. So thereby saving 10 minutes of taxi time. So this morning I flew to work with several issues, but that's very lucky. I'd much rather be in an aircraft than in an automobile.
So are those two propellers that are propped up on your front porch?
Well, that was a Warbird that I own. I blew it up last year.
Because it was a slow day and you needed
some. But that was a Warbird. A North American T-28 that I was lucky enough to fly for about 750 hours. And that's 1,425 horsepower. It burned various power settings. On takeoff, it burned 180 gallons an hour.
Is there kind of a weight to it?
And it make a lot of noise. And so when I would do air, I don't have a waiver for low altitude aerobatics, but I can do stuff I'm not supposed to do.
There's a barn around, look out.
I remember we had this briefing in South Lake Tahoe, and it was me and this little twin turboprop and another North American T-28. And he said, okay, now remember, 500 foot, this is the maximum, that's the ceiling or whatever. We can't go below it. 250 knots. So I was with a friend of mine in the back, and he goes, louder and faster, louder and faster. So we go downwind, we're done. We're turning towards the crowd. Now, you never fly over the crowd, right? So now I'm going like 320 knots, right? Which is more than 250. And I'm screaming. This son of a bitch is screaming. And there's the crowd, right? So I banked it. Now, those speeds, I banked it 60 degrees, 70 degrees, maybe more, I don't know. And then, so now I'm pulling about 5.5, 6 Gs, right? Pulling out of this thing. Then I landed, and then these people come up to me endlessly. Said, "You're the hottest thing out here, man." And then this lady came up and said, "Well, is this used in warfare?" I said, "Well, of course it is." I said, "This morning I was in Iraq bombing brown-skinned people," which she believed, of course.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Is that one an edit? Is that an edit one?
No. I love stories, man. That's why I do this. So tell me about that gorgeous classic car you've got out front.
Oh, that's a Bentley 52 Mark VI, as a matter of fact. So I like things with motors in them. Like, for example, I have 8 motorcycles. And I ride them every day. I went to San Francisco to have lunch on Wednesday in a Triumph Bonneville, which is fun. That Bentley, I've had other British cars. I've had Rolls Royces before. There's issues with them.
I was going to say.
Yeah. So they, for it's example,
like living on the edge.
For example, if you turn the steering wheel, it has a very big steering wheel, power steering. Get it? Leverage. So if you turn the wheel this way, it may do one of three things. It may go that way, it may go straight, or it may go that way. So, and they're very expensive.
I know.
You have to get it from England. You have to get it from London, wherever you need. So.
And you've obviously maintained this very well. It's shiny.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Now, what's the motorcycle you have in the tasting room?
That one's a Royal Enfield. That's made in India. I got an offer on a Triumph. Actually, I saw it today out the airport. I'm working on some things, details. Anyway, I like motorcycles. And you get to split lanes going to San Francisco. Do you know what that is? That means it's legal. Here's cars.
Oh, you mean in between?
They're going 20 miles an hour. I'm going 40.
Gotcha.
Actually, 30. But you go like that,
Yeah.
And then there's a bumper of a truck right there, like an inch away.
A little stunt driving.
But there's techniques. If I'm accelerating, like I own a Ducati, for example. If I'm accelerating, I pretty much got that space to myself because no one's going to race me on the freeway, and they couldn't if they wanted to. So that particular motorbike will get you out of trouble. Of course, it'll get you in trouble, too. But.
Depending on what day and the hour.
Huh? Yeah, exactly.
No, obviously you appreciate life.
Well, I think everyone does, but...
Well, unfortunately, not everybody does, but... Not just your lifestyle, but just your adventures and seeking out and educating yourself. And I'm guessing that's what led you to producing a wine for breast cancer research?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, Tim Harris was responsible for that marriage. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's just getting out, just starting. We have several products with a breast cancer label. It's just starting the project. I'm very much looking forward to that and see how we can develop that.
What types of wine are you thinking about?
Well, we already have two. We have a Petit Syrah and a Zinfandel. I was going to do a white of Chardonnay, and I didn't like the grape, so I'm not going to do it. But this will evolve, hopefully, and be an ongoing program. We'll see. Meanwhile, I'm very excited to be part of that whole thing and be endorsed by them as well.
Stay tuned.
Yes, exactly.
Charles Mitchell offers the Cure Series and Club for a Cure. 30% of all sales being donated to the organization Cure Breast Cancer to help raise research funding. The club offers 4 quarterly shipments per year, 2 to 3 bottles of Cure Series wine per shipment, 20% off all Cure Series wine, a pack of breast cancer research stamps, a signed book by Dr. Ernie Badai, the man behind the breast cancer research stamp, and the Blue Gaucho Project album. Fabulous group of musicians. Now that's a deal. Oh, by the way, visit the Charles Mitchell Vineyard website to enter a weekend getaway at the vineyard. It includes a private tasting with Charles, so you know it'll be entertaining. Do something different. Host an international wine tasting party.